It's 7:30 in the morning on a Monday. The four-year-olds at Rogers Lane Head Start in Wyoming are drawing lines with a ruler and cutting out strips of paper. Jazz Webb is here helping her daughter, Michaela.
Come on, let's cut another line.
Webb wears sweatpants and a black jacket. She's groggy, she works two jobs, and she never gets enough sleep. It seems like this moment couldn't possibly be significant. Just a four-year-old, a sleepy parent, and some construction paper. And yet, there's a surprising amount of evidence that moments like this matter a lot. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. For the next hour, we are going to talk about why moments like this matter for children and for the future of our state. And that story will take us into the world of preschool, its history in our country, whether it works, why it works, and whether it ultimately deserves your taxpayer dollars. But we are going to start this hour by talking about the brain. And, you know, you hear people say all the time that babies and toddlers have brains like sponges. But the truth is that scientists are really just beginning to understand how a young brain develops. And one of the things they've learned just in the last few years is that poverty can actually have a biological effect on the growing brain. So that's where we're going to start the hour, with the story of a brain growing up in poverty, told to us by some of the scientists on the leading edge of new research.
The message is pretty clear now from the science.
There are real structural differences in the brain as a function of family SES, family socioeconomic status.
Our circuits are constantly being altered by our experience.
There's no question about it.
My name's Lise Elliott. I'm Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School of Rosalind Franklin University. The brain first forms about 4 weeks after conception. There's a pretty steady formation of new neurons, which are the real information carriers. I calculated in my book, I think it's about 250,000 neurons a minute. 250,000 new neurons per minute between 4 weeks and 7 months prenatal. But they're not really connected to each other. Wiring up the neural circuits to do anything from seeing to talking to walking to doing calculus requires, obviously, experience.
Literally, our environment shapes the architecture of our brain in the first year of life. My name is Jack Shonkoff. I am the director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. What babies do right from the beginning, they look at you, they make sounds, they cry, and then they get a little bit older, they smile and coo and gurgle. And what shapes that brain circuitry is the response of adults around the child, what we call the serve-and-return interaction. The baby does something, the adult responds back. The adult does something, the baby responds. And it's the back and forth, the responsiveness, that shapes the brain circuits.
Yes, we actually have these microscopic changes in the way two neurons talk to each other that is capable of storing information. That is really where we get to the physical basis of learning.
So children who grow up in homes which tend to be more skewed toward more highly educated parents talk to their kids more, use more varied vocabulary, compared to children who, on average, in homes where parents have had limited education, tend to speak to their children less, use smaller vocabulary.
Whatever they're exposed to, those are the connections that will be preserved.
So by 18 to 24 months, you'll already see differences in the number of words a child can produce.
You know, sometimes people think, oh, if the brain is involved, if it's biological, that must mean it's genetic. And that in turn must mean, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And of course, that statement is wrong on many levels. But it's particularly wrong because we know that the brain is plastic. It is shaped by its environment. And particularly early on, it really needs the right environmental conditions to develop well. My name is Martha Farah. My title is Professor of Natural Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. And for the last few years, I've been studying the effects of childhood poverty on brain development. So we started by scanning some poor children from Philadelphia who have been followed since birth by my collaborator, Hallam Hurt. In fact, she's a neonatologist, so she got them when they came out. And when they were teenagers, we got structural brain images of them. We got MRIs of their brains. We found that kids who at age 4 were rated as having very supportive caretakers, typically mothers, but not always, their hippocampuses were different at age 15, 16 from those of kids who had less attentive, less warm parenting. Their hippocampuses...
The hippocampus. Back to the hippocampus.
...were different. So, it turns out that the hippocampus is involved in two, on the surface, very different things. One thing it's involved with is stress and stress regulation. Another important function of the hippocampus is memory. And you might say, you know, what the heck is the hippocampus doing these two totally unrelated things for? But it turns out they're not totally unrelated. Because in evolutionary time, you know, you could imagine, you know, when you see, you know, your next door caveman eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, you want to remember, ooh, saber-toothed tigers are really dangerous. I'm going to really stamp that memory in strongly.
Stress is kind of a double-edged sword. A little bit of stress is a good thing. It motivates us. You know, a child would never learn how to walk if they didn't take the risk of trying to stand independently. But then too much stress can be toxic to the brain.
When it's, you know, stress day in, day out, the system wasn't designed to handle that. Chronic exposure to stress hormones is actually neurotoxic. It kills brain cells.
What's happening is you become stressed out, you become increasingly stressed by experience, and sort of short-circuiting activity there, sort of like flooding out an internal combustion engine. My name is Clancy Blair. I'm a professor in the Department of Applied Psychology at New York University, and I study self-regulation in children, which is a variety of things, including the regulation of emotion, the regulation of stress physiology, and regulation through cognitive skills referred to as executive functions.
Executive function.
Executive function skills, the ability to focus
attention. Focusing attention.
The ability to control your impulses.
And that is just critical for everything. You can't focus on cognitive learning if you're upset.
If you haven't had a chance to learn to regulate at a very basic physiological level and to regulate attention and emotion, you're going to get in trouble in situations in which you need to do that. And I'm very interested in the effects of experience on the development of prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex, the very front of the brain.
Which is the area of the brain that's associated with the executive functions.
It turns out that the other place in the human brain that has lots of receptors for stress hormones, other than the hippocampus, is prefrontal cortex.
The idea is if children are under stress and experiencing a lot of stress in the home or in school, there's a neurobiology behind that that's related to why kids are having problems with attention, why kids are having problems with memory.
For young children, the challenge of poverty and the stresses of poverty is not a function of the family's income. It's a function of how well the parents, the caregivers, are able to kind of modify and adjust and moderate their behavior to create a safe and enriching environment for the child. So there are lots of parents living in poverty who do a magnificent job providing a good environment for early healthy development. But parents whose stress is related to poverty make it really difficult for them to be available emotionally and engaged, and who are preoccupied with just kind of keeping a roof over their head. That stress can interfere with their responsiveness to a young child, and that's when a child feels the stresses of poverty. The message is pretty clear now from the science.
There are real structural differences in the brain as a function of family SES, family socioeconomic status.
Whatever they're exposed to, those are the connections that will be preserved.
The effects of poverty on children's development are pervasive, and they last throughout early childhood and into young adulthood. There's no question about it.
It's beyond frustrating to think about just kind of looking at these children and saying, well, you know, we'll, if you have trouble later, we'll deal with it. You know, if you don't finish school and you're less of a productive citizen, or in the worst case scenario, you end up in jail, you know, we'll have to deal with that. To think that so much of that is preventable is unconscionable from a moral point of view. And from an investment point of view, it makes no sense whatsoever. So frustrating is an understatement.
Those were the voices of Lise Elliott, Jack Shonkoff, Martha Farah, and Clancy Blair. Philip Glass was on piano playing the role of the brain. So this brain science we just heard about is pretty new, but the idea of having programs to help young children in poverty is not new. And coming up, we're going to unearth some old audio from one of the biggest moments in early childhood education in our nation's history.
I believe that this is one of the most constructive and one of the most sensible and also one of the most exciting programs that this nation has ever undertaken.
47 years after the launch of Head Start. Has it worked? The answer, coming up in about 10 minutes on our State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Dustin Dwyer. We're talking this hour about the importance of early learning, especially for kids in poverty. And I want to get back to two people we met at the start of the hour.
My name is Jaslyn Webb. Everybody call me Jazz. And I'm Michaela's mom.
Michaela's mom.
Tell me about Michaela.
Michaela's very talkative, active.
I talk too much.
And she got a crazy personality.
Hey, no, I don't. She got a crazy.
Michaela, no. Tell me what you're going to be when you grow up.
A grown-up.
So earlier we heard some of the science about how growing up in poverty can affect young children, how it can even affect the biology of their brains. And I'm not going to lie, researching that stuff is a little overwhelming. You start to wonder how any kid in poverty can succeed. But then you meet a kid like Michaela and a mom like Jazz.
I just want them to, you know, do a little bit better than what I did. And never give up. No matter how times are, don't give up.
Jazz knows a little bit about that. She's a single mom with three kids and two jobs.
If I'm not at one job or at the other job, and if I'm not at neither one, I'm at home sleep. So that's pretty much, that's my day.
And how do you have time for kids?
On my days off, like today.
So this was recorded a couple of months ago, and I checked in with Jazz last week, and she says she's actually down to one job now, which is a lot less stressful. But the setup she was describing earlier can be a problem for some families, and it's one of the reasons there's a learning gap for kids in different kinds of homes. If you've got two parents and each of them has only one job, you'll get more time with them than if you have one parent who has two jobs. And that's just math. The numbers weren't looking good there for a while for Michaela and her two brothers. But that math still didn't take into account a determined parent, a creative parent.
When they was babies, they used to sing songs and make up songs with numbers or anything like that. Well, as I did stories, I made them throw over whatever part of the story they want to throw in. And I kept going to story like that, adding stuff in what they said.
And if you remember from earlier, this kind of back and forth is exactly what the experts say kids need early on to develop language skills. Jazz says she didn't have a lot of time for that when she was working two jobs. But you can tell that the fact she did it at all has made a difference. Michaela's one of the most talkative, most assertive four-year-olds I've ever met.
It gets her in trouble here. Because I feel like when as she's getting older, she thinks she can talk to anybody anyway. She don't think about it first. And she just talks.
Can I see my notebook?
So that's what gets her in trouble a lot.
And this is where the story could take a turn. Michaela is smart, crazy smart. But like many four-year-olds, she doesn't have a lot of self-control. She doesn't have the skills we heard about in the last segment, the skills that psychologists call executive functions. These are the skills that many children in poverty never get a chance to learn, and it holds them back for their entire life. But Michaela has lots of time to learn, and a parent who's trying to teach her. That's more than a lot of kids get. Michaela also has another big advantage. She does something that experts say makes a huge, huge difference. She goes to preschool.
Okay, boys and girls, where's our square club?
Right here.
Okay, right here. Square club. How about our...
In the fall, I spent a morning in her class at Rogers Lane Head Start in Wyoming, just south of Grand Rapids. The school is in a one-story brick building on a residential street not far from where Michaela and Jazz live. Nearly a million kids every year go through some sort of Head Start program. But it's not as if all of them are getting a standard education. The federal government administers Head Start through grants, which go out to 1,600 agencies around the country. The annual cost, as of 2011, was about $7.5 billion. When a lot of people talk about improving preschool in America, you'll hear them use examples from small projects with impressive results. But if you want to understand preschool as it exists now for most children in poverty, you have to look at Head Start. And the fact is, a lot of people have questions about whether Head Start is really doing a good enough job for kids. We're going to get to some of those questions later. But first, let's just talk about what happens in Michaela's class. The basics are not much different from any preschool in America. The preschool formula is kind of standard. There's an opening activity.
Could you collect the rulers for us?
There's circle time with introductions and songs.
Hello, Alfonso.
There's individual choice time. There's a snack. There's outside time.
The schedule is essentially the same.
Mary Hochwalt runs the Kent County Head Start program, which includes Rogers Lane. She says there is one way Head Start is different from other preschools.
Head Start has a lot of requirements, and it's good. It's just trying to get it all in is a challenge.
So take what happens after snack time, which itself has to fulfill certain nutritional requirements. After eating, every student gets a little paper cup, some water, and a toothbrush. Good oral hygiene is a requirement of Head Start. Every child is required to get a dental checkup after they enroll. They also get hearing and vision screenings and a physical. Head Start also offers social workers to meet with families at their homes, and they have bus service, which is pretty much unheard of for private preschools.
The other thing that makes us difference is our parent involvement. We can't do this without our parents.
This sentiment is something you will hear from any administrator in any school in the country, from preschool through high school. But Head Start has institutionalized parent involvement in a way that's pretty unique. Every Head Start location has an organization called the Parent Policy Council. And the parents on this council have the power to approve budgets, hire teachers, and fire teachers. And when you look at all these aspects of Head Start, from the parent policy councils to the dental checkups, it's not clear sometimes what they have to do with preschool. But the thing is, Head Start was never just intended to be about preschool. To understand what it is about, we have to go back to 1965. May 18th, exactly.
On this beautiful spring day, it's good to be outside in the Rose Garden.
President Lyndon Johnson stands in front of reporters. Joining him is Sergeant Shriver, a lifetime civil servant who would later be remembered as the architect of Johnson's war on poverty.
This is a very proud occasion for him and for us today, because it was less than 3 months ago that we opened a new war front on poverty. We set out to make certain that poverty's children would not be forevermore poverty's captives. We called our program Project Head Start.
And though the origins of the project could be traced all the way back to the Kennedy administration, it was on this spring day that Head Start became a reality.
Today, we're able to announce that we will have open and we believe operating this summer, coast to coast, some 2,000 child development centers serving as many as possibly 500,000 children. This means that nearly half the preschool children of poverty will get a head start on their future. These children will receive preschool training to prepare them for regular school in September. They will get medical and dental attention that they badly need. And parents will receive counseling on improving the home environment.
That first summer of Head Start would really just be a pilot project compared to what the program has become in the 47 years since the announcement. But it's clear from Johnson's speech that he never saw Head Start as just an education program. In fact, it's not in the Department of Education. For him, this was an ambitious, all-out assault on the cycle of poverty.
It shows that we are recognizing that poverty perpetuates itself. 5- and 6-year-old children are inheritors of poverty's curse and not its creators. Unless we act, these children will pass it on to the next generation like a family birthmark. This program this year means that 30 million man years, the combined lifespan of these youngsters, will be spent productively and rewardingly rather than wasted in tax-supported institutions or in welfare supported lethargy. I believe that this is one of the most constructive and one of the most sensible and also one of the most exciting program that this nation has ever undertaken.
You are listening to a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, we've been talking about the importance of preschool for kids in poverty. And what you just heard was some old scratchy tape of President Lyndon Johnson announcing Head Start in 1965. Now, more than 47 years since that announcement, Head Start has served tens of millions of children in poverty. Its total cost over the years, more than $130 billion. So, did it work? That simple question has a maddening answer. Let's start by trying to answer it on the small scale. If you talk to a parent or a teacher, you will hear that Head Start is clearly, undeniably helping kids. Sarah Traxler teaches the class at Rogers Lane Head Start that we visited earlier. That visit was actually in the fall, not too long after some of the kids first enrolled.
And, you know, they've already, just in the few months that they've been here, made a lot of gains as far as writing their name, recognizing some letters in their names.
This is not a subjective measure for Traxler. She actually has to track these things, another requirement of Head Start.
I have a list with everybody's name in the class on it, so I make my little notes here, and then I'll go later today to the computer, and I'll enter the information that I have. Then that keeps track of it for me.
And so far, so good. But of course, this is one teacher, one class. There are 1,600 Head Start agencies around the country. Many of them have more than one class. Almost 1 million kids every year go through Head Start. We want to know if it's working at that level. Is it ensuring, as President Johnson promised, that poverty's children would not become poverty's captives?
The research on Head Start is, at this point, clearly contradictory.
That's Tim Bartik. He's an economist at the Upjohn Institute in Kalamazoo, and he's one of the most rigorous researchers in America who studies early education.
On the one hand, there's been a number of very good studies, non-experimental studies, but good control groups, good comparison groups, that strongly suggest significant long-term effects of Head Start.
Bartik says one of these studies compared siblings when one went to Head Start and one didn't. Researchers found that the child who did attend Head Start was more likely to graduate high school and go to college, among other benefits. Another study looked at counties with high poverty rates where Head Start programs were put in place in the mid-60s and compared them to other counties with high poverty rates that did not get Head Start that early. In this study, the counties where Head Start was in place actually had fewer child deaths, possibly because of the Head Start health screenings. The study also found evidence that counties with Head Start had more kids who graduated high school.
So you have that research. Then you have this other research. There's been a random assignment experiment with Head Start that Congress mandated, and they've been following up. And what they found is that in terms of math and reading test scores, a lot of the effects of Head Start seem to fade by the time the kids are in first grade. You can find the effects when kids are in kindergarten, but by first grade or so, a lot of the effects seem to have faded. So what on earth is going on here?
What's going on, basically, is that after 47 years and $130 billion in investment, we don't know whether Head Start is working. Or at least we can't agree on how to measure whether it's working. It may very well be that what Head Start does, what all preschool does, is not something that really shows up on an elementary school math or language test. Bartik says what could be happening is that kids in preschool are developing what he calls soft skills, social skills, emotional skills, attention, focus, perseverance, those executive functions we keep hearing about. And that's what leads to higher graduation rates and higher earnings 20 years later. But Bartik says, even if you take this view, the results from Head Start are decent, but still not as impressive as many other preschool projects.
So what lesson do you take from that? I mean, the lesson I take from that is not that preschool doesn't work. The lesson I take from it is preschool works if it's run in a high-quality way. Head Start needs to up its game. And, in fact, people are trying to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Please have a seat.
In November of 2011, President Obama stood in front of an audience in Yadin, Pennsylvania, to announce what is possibly the biggest regulatory change in Head Start's 47-year history.
Now, under the old rules governing Head Start, there just wasn't enough accountability. If a program wasn't providing kids with quality services, there was no incentive to improve.
To understand what the Obama administration changed, you need to remember that the federal government doesn't actually run Head Start organizations around the country. Instead, Head Start funding comes in the form of grants. Until 2011, those grants were pretty much guaranteed to be renewed. But now, if a local Head Start doesn't meet certain criteria, the Obama administration will open up its grant to competition.
If classrooms are unsafe, if finances aren't in order, if kids aren't learning what they need to learn, then other organizations will be able to compete for that grant. We're not just going to put money into programs that don't work. We will take money and put them into programs that do. If a group's going to do a better job for the community, then they need that support.
After this announcement, about 130 Head Starts across the country were forced to reapply for federal funding in 2011. Five of them were in Michigan. The government was supposed to announce the winners of the new grants by the end of 2012. That didn't happen, so now those programs are just waiting to hear. Mary Hochwalt is not one of the people waiting on an answer. Kent County Head Start met the criteria to keep its funding. And she says she is in favor of accountability. But even she isn't exactly clear on how the government is applying these new rules.
What's confusing to many Head Starts, I think, is that sometimes there's reports of one instance, one thing that was out of compliance or what they call a finding, and they're theoretically thrown into recompetition. That's a concern.
The new standards have 7 criteria that each Head Start must meet. It sounds simple enough, but within that there are subparagraphs and reporting requirements and dates that certain things must be submitted. Hochwalt's point is, what if a local Head Start is doing everything right, but the paperwork gets turned in a week late? As written, the new federal rules say that Head Start could have its grant put up for outside competition. Now, if you're an outsider just trying to understand all this stuff, it doesn't take long for it all to sound just like a bunch of bureaucratic nonsense. And it gets back to the point from earlier that we haven't really decided what we're trying to get out of Head Start or how to measure it. Do we want it to improve test scores for kids? Or do we want it to lift kids out of poverty? Those are similar goals, but they're not the same goals. And Head Start is suffering from the confusion.
Does it feel like we know what we're trying to get out of this? Or at least, do you feel like the government and the structure that you're asked to operate under knows what it wants from you?
Boy, that's a really good question.
Maybe we should ask an even more basic question. Why are we doing preschool? If Head Start has been around a half century, cost well over $100 billion, and we still can't agree on what it does or whether it's doing it well, why should we as taxpayers fund preschool at all? Because when it's done right, it can have big economic benefits.
You were getting rates of return of somewhere between 6 to 10% per annum on like a passbook savings account. That looks pretty good by current standards.
The economic case for preschool. We'll get into it in about 10 minutes on our State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. This is a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. We're talking this hour about the importance of early education for kids raised in poverty. We're talking mostly about preschool. One thing we haven't really talked about yet is that one of the things preschool does is it shifts some of the responsibility for a child's development onto someone else. If we're talking about public-funded preschool programs, that responsibility, in some sense, is being shifted to taxpayers like you and me. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about whether it's worth our money. But I think we should talk first about how preschool actually came into existence in this country. Because Head Start is not where that story begins. I want to introduce you now to a guy named
Maris Vanauskas.
And he's
the Bentley Professor of History at the University of Michigan.
What Vanauskas studies is the history of education policy in the United States. He told me that preschool was big in the early 1800s. Vanauskas says the idea actually came from Europe during the Industrial Revolution. Americans traveling abroad saw these new preschools popping up in England.
And what they did then is they adopted the idea that we should have 2 and 3 and 4 year olds going to schools in America and giving the mothers a chance to either work or relieving them of having child care because the family size was much larger.
Vanoska says the original impulse was not all that different from what Lyndon Johnson imagined for Head Start more than 100 years later. It was a way to help kids in poor families. But just like with Head Start, the idea spread to middle-class parents as well.
By 1840, when we have very good data for Massachusetts, 40% of three-year-olds are now in school. And this is a very high number.
It's a high number even by today's standards. And these kids were actually learning things. Vanoska says children were expected to be able to read the Bible by age 4 or 5. But then this guy comes along. A doctor.
A very prominent doctor of mental health, Amariah Brigham.
Who was, in fact, the founding editor of what is today called the American Journal of Psychiatry. Brigham had some ideas about the education of children, and a shocking claim.
His medical practices showed that young children who are exposed to early learning are more apt to later become insane.
Insane! Brigham put his ideas in a book, Remarks on the Influence of Mental Cultivation and Mental Excitement Upon Health. You can read the entire book online, and it is quite a read. Brigham argues that early learning taxes young brains before they're ready, causing excessive blood flow that damages the brain, leading to both physical and mental problems, and even early death. This book was a sensation, according to Vanoskis, and it ended the preschool movement in America.
By 1860, there are almost no 3 or 4 year olds in Massachusetts schools.
That's the way it stayed for 100 years. Throughout the first half of the 20th century, parents still believed that young brains couldn't handle learning. And people forgot that preschool had ever been a thing.
We discovered infant schools 20, 30 years ago. Before that, historians didn't even know they existed.
Vanoska says when early learning advocates started pushing for Head Start in the 1960s, they all thought that it was a brand new idea. You are listening to a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. And next, I want to take you to a large sunlit room in Battle Creek. In one part of the room, Diego pushes little police cars and trucks across the carpet. In another, Maya puts plastic toppings on a toy pizza and asks her mom to take a bite. Lariah Todd is pressing stamps on a sheet of white paper while her dad Darren watches. This is not preschool. This is a playgroup put on by Early Childhood Connections in Battle Creek. We should say that this playgroup is funded by the Kellogg Foundation, which also funds State of Opportunity. The playgroup is for kids who aren't in any kind of preschool. It meets every Friday. Every Friday, Darren brings Lariah.
She's very energetic. She likes to play a lot. She's really into learning. She really wants to go to school. This here is like a almost like a type of school for her. So it's a school setting, so she likes it. Makes her feel like she's, you know, a little older.
How old are you right now?
3.
What do you like to do here?
Like to stamp.
You like to stamp?
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite stamp?
Star.
Lariah has been hoping for a chance to take her stamp skills to the next level and go to preschool. But there wasn't enough room in the public preschools for Lariah to go. When I talked to them in November, Darren told me they were on a waiting list until a spot opens up.
It's been a while now, but hopefully it should be soon.
That was in November. I called Darren last week. He says Lariah is still on the wait list. In Michigan, there are two main programs that offer free preschool to children in low-income families. Head Start and the state-run Great Start Readiness Program. But between these two, there still aren't enough seats available. GSRP doesn't even accept three-year-olds like Lariah. The governor is expected to increase funding for GSRP in the budget coming out next month. We're going to talk a little later about what's on the table for expanding preschool. But first, let's just ask whether we even should be spending money on preschool. We've talked about how it can help kids in poverty, but we haven't yet talked about what the rest of us get out of it, and whether it's worth the money. So let's bring back someone we heard from earlier, economist Tim Bartik from the Upjohn Institute. Now, he didn't start out studying preschool. He studied economic development strategies like business tax incentives or new sports stadiums. Then he got an email from an advocacy group that asked him to analyze the benefits of preschool on purely economic merits.
My first reaction was just a crazy email and really bad idea. It didn't make any sense to me.
But then he says he thought about what preschool does, which is, of course, to develop children's abilities. And that should eventually make them better workers, which should have an economic effect. For Bartik, this was a different way of looking at things. Usually when we talk about economic development, we're talking about either trying to grow or attract businesses with tax breaks, infrastructure improvements, or whatever.
So they're usually very much focused on what, you know, what economists would call labor demand. That is, we're trying to affect directly the behavior of firms.
We want the firms because the firms want workers.
And what occurred to me was that you could analyze early childhood programs as one way of, rather than working on the labor demand side, working on the labor supply side and boosting the quality of the local labor supply.
That way, the firms would want us because we have the best workers. Bartik analyzed the numbers, trying to figure out how much of an economic improvement you could get out of early childhood programs. And that turned into a book called Investing in Kids. It is a 350-page investigation of the economic returns of preschool. And spoiler alert, preschool pays off. It easily pays off just as well as other types of economic development, such as tax breaks. And Bartik isn't the only economist who's come to this conclusion. There's a whole literature now on the economic merits of preschool. Probably the most famous economist working on this literature is James Heckman. He's famous because in 2000, he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. He looks sort of like you would expect an economist to look. White hair, dark suit, round glasses. And he can get pretty excited about data. In the 1990s, he came across some data that was not exciting. At the time, there was a lot of interest in genetics. There was new research showing that a person's IQ was largely determined by genetics, and that IQ was by far the best predictor of how successful a person could be in life. Basically, people were stuck where they started out.
So I got a little depressed by that, and then I realized that you actually had, there was evidence, scattered evidence, that suggested that if you started early enough, you could actually make a difference.
Some of that evidence came from a project that started in Ypsilanti in the 1960s. It was a famous project called the Perry Preschool Project. There were a lot of aspects to Perry, but one important thing to know is that all of the kids enrolled in the program were from high-poverty homes. And on one measure, at least, the program was a failure.
The kids were entered at age 3 and 4. By age 10, the IQs of the kids in the program are no smarter than those randomized out. No difference.
This supported the depressing research Heckman had come across in the 1990s. There was no benefit to IQ for the kids in Perry preschools.
But yet, 40 years later, they have much greater social and economic participation. Higher earnings, the girls go to school much more, the boys are making money, they're employed much more than the boys who weren't in the program, much less crime.
These results probably sound familiar if you were around for our discussion on Head Start. It turns out this is common in preschool studies. Test scores often fade in elementary school. Then other benefits show up later in the form of higher graduation rates, higher earnings, and less crime. Heckman realized these benefits have an economic value. So he did what economists do, a benefit-cost calculation for the Perry Preschool Project. He says every dollar invested in Perry created a rate of return for society of about 6 to 10% per year. This result, just like the result Bartik got, was pretty conclusive. But it still didn't explain why preschool pays off. And we need to understand that. The key for Heckman was to stop caring so much about IQ.
The science of education, so-called science of education in the 1960s, was all based on cognitive psychology. And the measure of what schools created was IQ. And so you say, okay, IQ is very important. And it is important.
But what it also missed was there were all these other traits that somehow got lost.
These were the traits that were emphasized at the Perry Preschool Project. Heckman says the Perry preschoolers planned out their activity for the day, they did the activity, and then they reviewed the activity. It was an exercise of keeping kids on task, teaching them persistence and self-control.
So it was teaching these social skills. Some people say teaching character. And that's the hidden dimension of this program, which is totally ignored on our current public policy.
But it's a hidden dimension that just keeps coming up in this discussion. It's not about ABCs or numbers. It's about the child's ability to control themselves, to focus on work. Heckman calls it character. Bartik called it soft skills. People who study the brain call it executive functions. It's hard to measure these things on a test. But to Heckman, and to many other researchers, these are the skills that make the most difference for children's success and for the success of our economy. That's why economists care about preschool. I told Heckman that legislators in Michigan would be considering an increase to public preschool funding this year, and I asked if he had any advice. He said, look at Perry.
So I would say the legislature of Michigan should use its local wisdom in Ypsilanti.
We're going to try to tap into that local wisdom next. But first, I want to remind you, you're listening to a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. My name is Dustin Dwyer. So the Perry Preschool Project is still in operation, run by an organization called HiScope. Anyone can go check it out. I mean, I haven't, but my colleague Jennifer Guerra has, and she let me borrow some of her tape to share with you. The kids come in around 8:30. And Jennifer says they make their way to a big blue rug for some story time.
Buenas noches, elefantes.
Then they read the message board to learn what's new in the class that day.
The keeper says goodnight to the elephants.
Then it's time to plan.
If your name starts with D, D, go to your planning table. Delilah.
This is part of what makes the Perry preschool model unique, something they call plan, do, review.
You're going to use the little blocks today. What do you think?
Once the students plan their activities for the day, they have about an hour to do those activities. And it's all child-initiated play, whether it's mushing up Play-Doh into a birthday cake, building a fort out of blocks, or crawling around like a puppy. The preschool director, Sue Gainsley, says once the hour is up, the kids return to their small groups and review what they did.
And what has been shown is children who are intentional and make these plans often develop more complex play. They begin to think about materials in different ways.
And she says they develop the kind of skills we've been talking about. They're focused and thoughtful. They have the self-control to carry out their plan. Larry Schweinhart is president of HiScope, which runs Perry. He says a high-quality pre-K program must have four main ingredients: engaged parents, a way to evaluate students, active learning, and good teachers. The last ingredient is the hardest to carry out for most preschools. It costs money to hire highly trained teachers with bachelor's degrees. Many preschool programs pay their teachers less than half of what most K-12 public school teachers make. And Schweinhart says two-thirds of the cost of a high-quality pre-K goes to pay teachers. And if you don't spend the money, you won't get the results that Perry's gotten. And the HiScope Perry preschool costs a lot, roughly $11,000 per child per year. That's more than three times the cost of the state-funded Great Start Readiness pre-K program. Now, Jennifer Guerra pressed Schweinhart on this high cost.
You're effectively asking a lot of people to help pay for other people's children to get into preschool.
Because if you don't pay for them with early childhood education, you're going to pay more for them because they're going to suck up services from the community and from the schools. They're going to be winding up being very costly because they're engaging in crime. And we wind up paying through the nose.
Schweinhart ultimately says the question is, pay now or pay later. Now, first, there is no chance that the state of Michigan is going to increase preschool funding to the level that Perry does. Not anytime soon, anyway. But the HiScope Foundation actually did an analysis of the state's current preschool program and found good results. And Governor Snyder said in his State of the State last week that he wants a funding increase to allow more kids to attend. Right now, the state estimates that 29,000 four-year-olds meet the eligibility requirements to attend free state-funded preschool, but there's not enough money to fit them in. Advocates were hoping that the state would increase funding enough to have spaces for all of those four-year-olds, which would cost an estimated $130 million a year.
I don't believe we can accomplish all of that, and I'm open to coming up with creative ideas to get there. But I think it's important we make a major commitment, a major budget commitment, to get as many kids in as possible and get us on a path to getting all those kids in Great Start and an early childhood program.
The number that's been tossed around since the speech would be an increase of about $75 million in next year's budget. That would still leave thousands of four-year-olds without access to preschool, but it's a pretty huge increase compared to the current budget. And maybe we should just leave it at that. But if you heard the governor's speech last week, you know that preschool was not one of its main topics. It really only took about 30 seconds. The governor's biggest request was for more road funding. $1 billion a year in road funding. $100 million was too much to spend on preschool. But the governor is fighting for 10 times that amount with roads. And it'll require essentially a tax hike. The governor estimates it'll cost about $120 per year per vehicle. Tim Bartik at the Upjohn Institute says universal preschool for every four-year-old in the state would cost about $30 per person a year. Now, we all know how bad Michigan's roads are. Lots of people want improved roads, and every analysis I could find supports the basic claim the governor's making, that roads have a good return on investment. But so does preschool. What the governor is saying about making our roads fund solvent is...
it's time.
What he says about giving all disadvantaged four-year-olds a chance at preschool is...
I don't believe we can accomplish all that.
The governor's official budget proposal should be out within a few weeks. We'll see what he decides we can accomplish with preschool. You've been listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. This documentary was informed by the Public Insight Network. Thanks to Jennifer Guerra and Sarah Alvarez. Vincent Duffy and Sarah Hewlett did the editing. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, our partner with communities where children come first.